Nuclear amnesia. The nuclear industry and its enablers in government are experts in making the public forget that they've done anything wrong and that there's any lingering danger that comes from the nuclear things that they've been doing. So they deny accusations, delay responses, and when all else fails, disguise the deadly remains of what they've done as, well, a wildlife refuge. That's what happened at Rocky Flats near Boulder, Colorado, where radioactively contaminated buildings that once produced plutonium pits for nuclear bombs were knocked down and barely buried, all signs of its nuclear operation hidden, while bike trails and picnic tables were installed for the unsuspecting public to enjoy the space without knowledge of what they're potentially exposing themselves to. So when an artist with personal ties to Rocky Flats spends years making a film intended to reawaken people to the truth of what exists on that site, and he tells you,
there was no cleanup at all in what is now the Rocky Flats Wildlife Refuge, nor in the offsite areas. And the accidents that had happened there, a large fire in 1957, a 1969 fire, leaking waste barrels, waste dumped into drinking water supplies. None of that contamination outside of where the buildings stood was actually cleaned up. And the buildings that stood there were called the most radioactively contaminated buildings in America. And that was a label that the Department of Energy gave it. Those buildings were imploded and buried under 3 to 6 feet of soil.
That's it?
Yes.
Well, when Jeff Geip, director of the new Rocky Flats documentary, The Half-Life of Memory, breaks silence on what really happened at that weapons facility, and surprise that it ever existed, you get yet another glimpse of that dangerous, deadly, awful seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with artist and filmmaker Jeff Geip, whose documentary on Rocky Flats, The Half-Life of Memory, America's Forgotten Atomic Bomb Factory, premieres on November 2nd as part of the Denver Film Festival. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than either of the U.S. presidential candidates is talking about. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 21st, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting off here in the U.S., lots of not good news about power reactors. In Pennsylvania, at Three Mile Island, site of the 1979 meltdown at Reactor 2, and reactor number 1 has been shut down for 5 years, Constellation Energy has ordered a $100 million main power transformer in an attempt to restart the reactor. This is in the wake of last month's announcement that Constellation had signed a 20-year power contract with Microsoft to help restart the plant. Their goal is for TMI-1 to provide all of its energy to Microsoft's data center for artificial intelligence. No modern U.S. nuclear power plant has been restarted after fully shutting down, and there are concerns about the deterioration of equipment that was left in the reactor unit. The move is being opposed by a consortium of anti-nuclear NGOs, including Three Mile Island Alert. Now, Amazon has signed an agreement with Dominion Energy Virginia's utility company, to explore the development of a, which makes it sound like one, small modular nuclear reactor near Dominion's existing North Anna nuclear power station. Again, AI and cloud computing, with their massive and increasing need for energy, are Amazon's motives. The technology does not yet exist. There are no approved designs through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for a small modular nuclear reactor, and no prototypes have yet been built. Yet Amazon is going to invest more than $500 million to develop these small modular nuclear reactors. The small, by the way, referring to the energy output, not the size of the facility or its footprint on the land. And not to be left behind, Google has announced plans to build 7 nuclear reactors in the U.S. to help power the company's data centers and artificial intelligence systems. The announcement comes just a month after Microsoft said it would fund the opening of Three Mile Island, and Amazon made its announcement. At Palisades Nuclear Power Plant in Michigan, which was shut down in 2022, Holtec International, the company that owns and wants to restart this shuttered nuclear reactor, is already working on preliminary site plans for a pair of 300-megawatt small modular nuclear reactors, in addition to restarting the 1970s-era nuclear facility in 2025. Again, be aware that no small modular nuclear reactors, sometimes referred to as SMRs or SMNRs, have yet been built. Dozens of companies worldwide are working on their own designs, but nothing has been constructed, not even a prototype. As for problems at existing nuclear power plants, here's...
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, none that's out a week.
Someone should get the Nuclear Regulatory Commission a book on etiquette and proper manners, because they sure don't know how to apologize. In November of 2022, the Monticello nuclear reactor in Minnesota leaked some 829,000 gallons of cooling water containing a large concentration of radioactive tritium. Xcel Energy and the NRC gave out plenty of assurances that the radioactive water didn't come anywhere close to the Mississippi River. However, on May 15, in an extremely underreported story, NRC Senior Environmental Project Manager Stephen J. Koenig apologized for the commission staff's oft-repeated claim that the leaked tritium from the 53-year-old reactor had not reached the Mississippi River, which provides drinking water for 20 million people. But what an apology! Koenig said, "I would like to take a moment to address and clarify some miscommunication," and stated that after a draft environmental statement was updated, we, quote, "conclude that there were some very low concentrations of tritium in the Mississippi River. So we apologize for this miscommunication." He's not apologizing for the tritium that made its way into the Mississippi River, and he downplays that, but tritium is radioactive. You get it in your body. It's up close and personal with your blood, organs, and DNA. You're going to have some problems. Miscommunication is a nuclear industry code word for false assurances made to the press that no tritium had been found by Xcel's testing of the river. The radioactive tritium contamination in Xcel's groundwater tests near the Mississippi exceeded the federal EPA drinking water limit. No apologies for what they had done, just the fact that they, shall we say, lied about it. Oh, no. It was just a miscommunication. Yeah, right. And that's why Xcel Energy and the NRC, you are both this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
Thanks to John LaForge of NukeWatch for that story. Representative Mike Levin is sponsoring a bill, H.R. 9786, the Nuclear Waste Administration Act of 2024. The bill seeks to create a new federal agency called the Nuclear Waste Administration. According to an opinion piece written by Sharon and Ace Hoffman, the bill is, quote, A blatant attempt to circumvent the rules forbidding interim storage of nuclear waste until a permanent repository is established. End quote. They get into a lot of details about how the semantics are being manipulated in this bill, and we will link to their article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 696. A HuffPost article from October 20th states that Democratic candidates in several key Senate races are increasingly embracing nuclear power as tech companies, banks, and governments pour money into building new reactors to power data centers, air conditioning, and extreme weather. We will link to that article. And this one from truthout.org. It leads with the headline, "Costly replacement of ICBMs with Sentinel missiles increases the risk of nuclear war." But they open up an issue not often addressed in their subheading, which is, "Many of our unmet needs as U.S. citizens are due in part to the cost of the U.S. nuclear arsenal." It goes on to point out that the world is already awash in nuclear weapons with an astonishing capacity for mass death. The U.S. has 14 Ohio-class nuclear-armed submarines. A single one of those 14 submarines can launch 24 missiles. Each missile can carry 8 independently targeted warheads with blast forces many times greater than the Hiroshima bomb. The missiles launched from just one such submarine can obliterate the major cities of any nation on Earth. Again, we'll link to it. And in Piketon, Ohio, nuclear activists have created a haunting Halloween display to raise awareness about what has been called the most serious accident in the history of the Piketon atomic plant. The display reflects the March 7, 1979 incident when a cylinder carrying a dangerous and radioactive material was dropped, rupturing and releasing hazardous substances into the atmosphere. Some nuclear experts argue that the amount of radioactive material released in Piketon in that incident was greater than the amount released during the Three Mile Island nuclear accident in Pennsylvania in 1979. Potatoes, patatas, it's all bad. And thanks to the activists, including Vinakali from Press, who put this appropriately scary Halloween display together. In Japan, last week's announcement that the 2024 Nobel Peace Prize went to Nihon Hidankyo, the Japanese Confederation of A&H Bomb Sufferers Organization, sent waves of elation and excitement through the peace and disarmament movements worldwide. The general public seems to have gotten in on the action, too, given all the media coverage and the many messages of support that the group has received. "The prize is a reminder that we must abolish and eliminate nuclear weapons," they said. However, the moment is also considered bittersweet because many of the atomic bomb survivors, the Hibakusha, who have been so integral to the anti-nuclear movement, have already passed on, and the ones who are still alive, essentially all in their 80s and 90s, as they consider world leaders, most especially leaders of the 9 nuclear weapons-possessing countries, have clearly not been listening to their stories of pain, suffering, and devastation in the aftermath of the atomic bombings. We'll link to a very poignant story about this in The Nation. Ukraine and Russia are facing off over nukes. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky reportedly told Republican candidate for President Donald Trump that Ukraine will either restore its status as a nuclear state or become a NATO member, with Kyiv preferring NATO. Russian President Vladimir Putin immediately responded that Russia would not let Ukraine get nuclear weapons and said that any move by Ukraine to get nuclear weapons could not be concealed and would draw an, quote, appropriate Russian response. "Russia will not allow this to happen no matter what," he told reporters. In a possibly related story, the United States will expand an air base in Eastern Europe to house nuclear-capable fighter jets. Plans are in place to upgrade Kecskemét Air Base, a Hungarian military facility located southeast of the capital, Budapest. The base will likely house U.S.-made F-15 Eagle Strike tactical fighter jets, which are certified to carry the new B-61-12 nuclear gravity bombs. India continues to modernize its nuclear arsenal, with at least 4 new weapon systems and several new delivery platforms under development to complement or replace existing nuclear-capable aircraft, land-based delivery systems, and sea-based systems. This article in the Bulletin of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists estimates that India may have produced enough military plutonium for 130 to 210 nuclear warheads, but likely has produced only, put that in quotes, only, around 172 bombs, though the country's warhead stockpile is likely growing. This is from an article that appeared in The Nuclear Notebook, which is researched and written by the staff of the Federation of American Scientists Nuclear Information Project. Again, as with anything dealing with the intricacies of nuclear weapons, there's a lot of jargon to be unpacked, and to facilitate that, we will, of course, link to this article, which you can download in PDF form, from our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 696. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, what bothers you most about nuclear? The Armageddon-level threat of weapons? Forever quantities of cancer-causing highly radioactive waste? Contamination of the land, water, food? The obscene amounts of money nuclear siphons away from genuine renewable energy and human services? You can do nothing about nuclear threats without knowing the truth about what this technology is and what it does. And communicating that truth is what Nuclear Hot Seat is all about. Every week, this show provides you with the information you need to understand what's happening in the nuclear industry. They don't fund us, heaven knows, so we're not influenced by the millions of dollars they spend on their unending propaganda media PR machine. We cover what you face in terms of threats to health, welfare, and safety, as well as what you, what we, what any of us can do about it. But we can't keep this show going without your help. Nuclear Hot Seat relies exclusively on donations, and we can't survive without your support. So if you're grateful for the information you get from this show every week, now is the time to help us out. Be it a one-time donation of any amount, or a monthly recurring donation, even the same as a cup of coffee, $5, means you'll be supporting the services required to keep this show running. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means your donation is tax deductible. And we make it easy for you to do. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. Or you can send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount too small or too large, so don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and donate now to help keep our nuclear news online. And whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful. Now, here's this week's featured interview. A documentary about Colorado's Rocky Flats is about to have its world premiere at the Denver Film Festival. The Rocky Flats site, near Denver and Boulder, produced 70,000 plutonium pits, that's the core and trigger for nuclear bombs, and did so between 1952 and 1989. Which is when it was permanently shut down for environmental crimes. Nuclear enablers had done everything in their power to obscure its history and hide the legacy of this highly contaminated site. As a result, public awareness has faded, and most people in the area have no clue that the wildlife refuge across the road is actually a radioactive site. All that is about to change. The half-life of memory, America's Forgotten Atomic Bomb Factory, a film by director-producer-videographer Jeff Geip, is a gripping retelling of the history of Rocky Flats, the public protests against it, and how its legacy has been disguised. Jeff is an accomplished visual artist and filmmaker, known for works on the far-reaching implications of the U.S. nuclear legacy. His deep connection to the subject matter stems from his upbringing near the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant, where his father was employed. The 55-minute film is about to have its world premiere on November 2nd at the Denver Film Festival. To give you a sense of this powerful documentary, here's an audio clip.
The Rocky Flats plant makes plutonium parts for nuclear weapons. Last May 11th, two buildings were gutted by fire.
Scientists recently found traces of radioactive plutonium.
People who live near that plant may be exposed to a cancer hazard.
Wastes burned, dumped into landfills, discharged into streams.
Some of the highest levels of radioactive plutonium in the world.
When is enough enough? People! We have been lied to enough.
People living near the plant are breathing tiny particles of plutonium. Allegations of a conspiracy by plant officials.
Officials repeatedly denied that working at the weapons plant.
Words like nightmare and scandal were
used. Officials say there is no cause for alarm.
I don't like to call anyone liars. Let's just say that they have stretched the credibility gap beyond repair.
And that's just the film's first 60 seconds. I spoke with the director of Half-Life of Memory, Jeff Geip, on Friday, October 18, 2024. Jeff Geip, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on the completion and the launch of your film, Half-Life of Memory.
Thank you so much.
First of all, give us a sense of your background as a filmmaker and an activist.
So this is actually my first feature film that I've completed. I grew up very near the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant where my father worked for about 2 decades. And honestly, when I was living in Colorado, I didn't know much about Rocky Flats or what took place there. And my dad wasn't able to speak about it. So it was an issue that I really sort of dove into after I left the state. I went to New York for grad school and was kind of just blown away with the fact that I didn't know any of this, even though I was so close to it and so familiar in a way with it. And so it was really kind of an eye-opener. It felt like my life was sort of a lie, you know, my growing up. I'm sort of, in a way, a product of Rocky Flats, being that my dad worked there and I was raised very near the plant.
How did you first find out the truth about Rocky Flats and how much was hidden from you?
You know, it was probably through Making a Real Killing by Lynn Ackland. It was his book that came out in 2008, and I probably read it in 2009. And then Kristen Iverson's book, Full Body Burden, came out in 2012. That was enlightening as well. And, you know, just diving into the history of the plant, there's also the Rocky Flats Ambush Grand Jury that I read after that, although it came out even earlier. It was like mid to end 2000s. I don't remember the exact date. And all of those books were really enlightening and also kind of frightening to learn that this was taking place like very near me and where my family still lives.
So your family is still there?
Yes, my family is still very close to the site, downwind of the plant.
How did you respond when you started learning this information, and what did it do to your determination to do something about it?
Well, my background is actually, I'm a visual artist, which is why I went to New York, went to grad school out there. So at first, I just started making art that was tied to, was related to, or inspired by Rocky Flats. I didn't necessarily speak directly to it, but it was definitely informed by what I had learned.
Among the art you created was a rather visible monument to Rocky Flats. Explain how you came about making it and what you decided to make.
Around 2012, there were housing developments that were going in very near Rocky Flats. And this was an area that had remained undeveloped, partially because it was contaminated. So whenever they started to develop this was after I had become informed about what was going on, the lack of proper cleanup that had occurred there. So I went out there and was, you know, passing out info flyers to people that were looking at houses. And it became very stark that people had no idea what was going on there, had no idea about the history or the fact that that area was contaminated. I realized that there needed to be something there all the time, which was not possible for me, being that I lived in New York at the moment. So I ended up creating a larger than life size horse statue that's wearing a respirator and a hazmat suit. It was kind of challenging to find a place to actually put it. I initially was going to just go out there and plant it at the site. And it became clear that people weren't happy that anyone was raising awareness about what was going on and that it would be likely taken down or destroyed. So it took me about 2 years, ended up going door to door, and finally found an amazing couple who had property right on the south side of the plant. And they had offered to put it up there. It's up there now. It actually was installed 9 years ago today, believe it or not.
Happy anniversary. How was it received by the people there?
When it first went up, there was actually, I was contacted by the press immediately, which was unexpected. I think some people found it intriguing and either wanted to know more or wanted to get the issue out. And I kind of held off on that. I was like, well, we'll have an official dedication for it. And unfortunately, before that dedication happened, somebody came with large equipment and ripped it out of the ground and then smashed it with a sledgehammer. So that was pretty traumatizing to see that that had happened after years of work on it and lots of money put into the sculpture. So I then rebuilt the sculpture and put it back out there, fortified it, put up surveillance and cameras, which is unfortunate that that had to happen. The sculpture is still up now. It's currently the only actual reminder of the history and contamination that exists out there. Even though the site is a national historical landmark, it has not been acknowledged by state, local, or federal governments.
Why am I not surprised? Before we go into the making of the film, give us the history of Rocky Flats briefly. What it was, what it made, and what happened there up to the FBI getting involved.
Yeah, so Rocky Flats was part of a whole complex of Department of Energy facilities. And it was actually started by the predecessor agency, which was the Atomic Energy Commission. And it was announced in 1951. It eventually opened and started producing what they called pits or triggers for nuclear weapons in 1953. And these pits or triggers set off hydrogen bombs, and they themselves are atomic bombs. So the plants produced around 70,000 of these atomic bomb triggers over the course of 40 years. The site was eventually closed down. Plutonium bomb production was stopped in 1989 after the FBI raided the plant for environmental crimes for dumping nuclear waste and burning waste illegally. Before that, there was about 10 years of constant activism that had picked up after a large 1969 fire. And before that fire had happened, there were actually 400 plus other fires that took place, plutonium fires that took place at the plant that the public was not made aware of. So it was that 1969 incident that was very visible that really caught the attention of people that became concerned and sparked the activism that followed.
Were you one of the activists at that time?
I was not born at that time.
That makes it hard to participate.
Yeah, I know many of the activists have become good friends with a lot of them. It was started by a group of women who were very spiritual. One was a Quaker, one was a Catholic nun. And then it was picked up by people like Daniel Ellsberg and a group called the Rocky Flats Truth Force, who made an encampment and occupied the railroad tracks and stayed there for over a year to try to block nuclear shipments of radioactive waste in order to try to close the plant.
70,000 plutonium pits for nuclear weapons. Did that translate into 70,000 bombs that were ultimately created?
It is. And they have never acknowledged that they actually created bombs and still will not acknowledge that. They call them plutonium parts for nuclear bombs.
Oh, yeah. Like screws and wrenches. And I'm sorry.
Yeah, something that has never really been acknowledged. And unfortunately, even press has not picked up on that. Many journalists don't pick up on that. Even today, you know, they'll still say they'll call them triggers or pits or buttons or cores. They have all kinds of euphemisms for what they actually are.
Yeah, they don't like to say the P word if they can help it, plutonium.
Right.
So, as you became aware of the issues and you applied your art to it in this very visible way, it's a great visual. We will have it on the website for this episode. What motivated you, never having made a film before, to decide, I think I need to make a film about this?
It was really participating in meetings that were taking place on the opening of the Rocky Flats National Wildlife Refuge, which is what the site had become. It, after 10 years of, it's hard to call it, remediation efforts, the site was declared clean by regulatory agencies, including the Department of Energy. However, there was no cleanup at all in what is now the Rocky Flats Wildlife Refuge, nor in the offsite areas. And the accidents that had happened there, a large fire in 1957, a 1969 fire, leaking waste barrels, waste dumped into drinking water supplies, none of that contamination outside of where the building stood was actually cleaned up. And the buildings that stood there were called the most radioactively contaminated buildings in America. And that was a label that the Department of Energy gave it. Those buildings were imploded and buried under 3 to 6 feet of soil.
That's it.
Yes, it's very concerning, especially since this site is historically windy. There's a lot of events. There's three water springs that, like, creeks, the heads of the creeks start at Rocky Flats. And so, there's a lot happening with the site environmentally, and dust is constantly blowing out there. There's hurricane force winds that are pretty regular that happen many times a year. And so, this plutonium that burned went up and became plutonium oxide, which is a very, very fine dust, even smaller than dust. And it went as far as Southeast Denver and as far north as Boulder. And so nothing was cleaned outside of what they call the donut hole, or has been called the donut hole, which still remains a Superfund site that public hopefully will never have access to. But the refuge area that is open to the public was never cleaned. No remedial action was taken, meaning they left it as is.
What kind of monitoring is done on the site and for the site? And has there been any kind of epidemiology to go over health statistics and find out what the cancer rates or what the other radiation acknowledged illnesses might be in the surrounding area?
Yeah, so the Department of Energy has always been the one who have managed and reported the studies on the contamination that exists out there, which raises a lot of questions about the impartiality of those tests. So what has happened is there was an intergovernmental agreement between the Colorado Department of Health and the Department of Energy, and the Department of Energy pays the Colorado Department of Health for the for oversight, I guess, or additional testing. And since that time, the Department of Health has really taken a back seat to this issue and just followed the line of the Department of Energy that everything is safe out there and clean. And it is constantly pitched as being clean, even though there was no remediation. And as far as the health studies go, there has not been a comprehensive health survey. The Colorado Department of Health has done a sort of, I don't even know how to describe it. They did a study where they included areas that are known to not have been affected by Rocky Flats and mixed that in with areas that have been affected by Rocky Flats, diluting ultimately the findings. So, according to the Colorado Health Department, there's no increased risks of cancer. But there is a group, the Rocky Flats Downwinders, which was founded by Tiffany Hansen. And they have gone out and done surveys and tried to find out what is happening in the community. Is there more cancers or rare cancers that exist? And their findings are really horrifying. They're not scientific studies. I mean, to do an epidemiology study that would be comprehensive with lots of money, and I don't even know if it can be done. It's a very difficult thing to prove that a cancer came from any specific place. And I know people are working towards that, and I hope it comes sooner than later so we know the truth about what's going on.
So let's circle back to the birth of this film. How did you get the idea to make one, and what motivated you, not a filmmaker, not trained in this way, to take on such an enormous project?
Yeah, it was those meetings that I sort of alluded to earlier, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Department of Energy, and the EPA put together these public meetings, which were required before they opened the refuge. And it was really a sham. There was no public participation. You could not ask questions. There was no back and forth. And there was really no addressing the issues other than, should we allow bikes and should we allow horses and where were we going to put the trailers? And, you know, it was really a rewriting of the history of what was going on out there. It was just, this is now a refuge, and how are we going to support use of this refuge? So it was those meetings that are very eye-opening, and I started to just film those because I thought it was important for the community. And that's really where it began. And then I realized, you know, people do not know what's going on out there. It's great that the horse is there, but it's not enough information, and it hasn't gotten out there in a wide enough way to really alert people in this community or the country what has happened there.
When did you start working on the film, and what proved to be your biggest challenges in moving forward with the project?
I began filming those meetings in 2016, and so I conducted interviews, still conducting interviews with all sorts of people that are involved with Rocky Flats, including officials, former Rocky Flats workers, activists, community members, sick residents. And, you know, I really wanted to capture as much as I can, because this is an issue that while these people are around and have the knowledge, actual knowledge from being on site or having these experiences, I wanted to just capture as much of that as possible. Unfortunately, many of the workers have passed or are ill, and the people that were around when Rocky Flats was in operation are aging. And sooner than later, you know, that knowledge is going to be lost. So it wasn't necessarily a film to begin with. It was more capturing these oral histories. But in realizing that this needed to get out there, that's when I really began in earnest to make a film, thinking that it would take me a year to complete. And it's been since 2016.
Yeah, and I thought I would do Nuclear Hot Seat for a couple of weeks, and that was almost 700 episodes ago. In the time that you have been working on the film, what have you found most surprising or most shocking in the information you have uncovered?
I think it's really the stories of the workers who were there. I think there's this perception that the workers feel like it's clean and that everything is good. And there are a few workers who were still under the DOE payroll that carried that line. But a majority of them are very concerned about the lack of cleanup and what is going on out there, the developments that are happening. And many of them say, even though they were working with these materials, radioactive materials, they say that they would never step foot on the refuge. And that's very alarming.
I've often said that the reason that so many contaminated nuclear sites end up being nature preserves is that animals don't vote. It's a disguise. It is a whitewashing. We have area around Santa Susana Field Lab here in Southern California, which are major hiking and rock climbing places. There's even a kids camp, an overnight camp that's at Brandeis Bardeen that is just over the hill. Or there was. I don't know if it's still in operation. But always it's a matter of disguising it as, oh, we're taking this back to nature, when really there's no way to do that because of the contamination.
Yeah, that's a major issue. And I think that's why this issue has been forgotten and is not known by people who are younger than 20 years old that never saw Rocky Flats in the plants. This sort of remaking these sites into nature preserves, it does a couple of things. The one good thing it does is it prevents it from being developed, which was the initial intent. But the unfortunate side effect is that it greenwashes the history of what happened there. And it's clear that in opening the site and calling it a wildlife park, that that is the intent. There is no museum. There is no official signage that tells people the history of that area.
One of the things that surprises me is that the University of Colorado at Boulder, Boulder, Colorado, being certainly in my thinking or my awareness, a very liberal kind of environment. What has been the awareness or the activism coming off the university being that close?
Well, back in 1978, when the first rally took place out at Rocky Flats, there was a lot of CU students who became involved and later joined the Rocky Flats Truth Force in their occupation. So there was a lot of activism and awareness in Boulder, and I would say a majority of the activism and the activists came from Boulder. Today, I mean, it's such a non-issue that there isn't much activism. There are several small groups that have been trying to raise awareness. But there is no large-scale activism like what happened in the 70s and the 80s. I mean, back in that time, there would be 10,000 people that would show up at Rocky Flats to protest. And it launched the nuclear freeze movement. The nuclear freeze movement was announced at Rocky Flats. And one of the co-founders is Pam Solo, who was one of the very first activists out there. She's a Catholic nun, sister of Loretto. It was something that they really raised awareness, and the methods that they chose and the creative methods that they used to spread awareness worked so well that it eventually became the nuclear freeze movement, grew out of Rocky Flats into the nuclear freeze movement.
The film is about to have its world premiere. Tell us about that. When is it taking place and where is it taking place?
Yeah, so the world premiere of Half-Life of Memory is going to take place at the Denver Film Festival, which is located in Denver.
And Denver is how many miles away from Rocky Flats?
From the very center of Denver, it's 15 miles upwind and upstream. So really, it's probably more like 7 or 8 miles from the edge of Denver. And it's in the suburbs of Denver. It's all kind of grown together.
So with the film having its premiere there, what kind of attention or publicity is it kicking up in terms of, gee, this is history that many of us don't know about that we need to know about?
I really commend the Denver Film Festival for taking it on, because I think here in Denver, it's such a contentious issue that that's also partially why it's been swept under the rug. Here you have government agencies saying the site is safe, that it was all cleaned up. So I think there's a real misunderstanding there. And many people are not willing to take this issue on. Being a visual artist, I've tried many times to show my work at institutions and have been told that it is too radical for arts institutions. And they're worried about their conservative funders and how they might take it. So it's been kind of difficult to get the film out. And so I commend Denver for taking it on. And I'm sure some of their funders are not going to be happy about it either.
But that's the purpose of art. It's the same as with journalism. It is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And if it's not doing that, it just doesn't qualify. What about Boulder? Do you have any screenings that are planned for Boulder?
Yes, I will definitely premiere the film in Boulder. I'm not sure the dates of that yet, hoping maybe the Denver Film Festival will pick it up. But I'm also looking at a couple of other venues. The Denver Public Library has actually been great, and I've showed early cuts of this film there. They've been very supportive. Even had an art exhibit that I curated there a couple of years ago, and it was very well attended. The great thing about public places and art in public places is that these people will happen upon it and discover something that they didn't know. Whereas like in a gallery or a museum, you're going to get a certain sector of the population that is coming specifically for that. So even though my work has not been accepted in the art world, I think the public venue is, for me, much better as far as raising awareness and getting it out to the public.
What about people who aren't in Colorado? If they want to view the film, what either currently exists or is in the pipeline for them to be able to access it online?
Yeah, so I'm working out the details on that, but it will be available for streaming early next year. So I don't know the exact date or the platforms, but it will be available. And if anybody would like to have a screening or arrange something like that, I would love to get it out and share it across the U.S.
Where would they go to get that information to you and do an outreach?
They could reach me either through the website, halflifeofmemory.com, or my website, jeffgeif.com. There's links there that you could contact me or reach out to me on social media or however. If people are interested in the film, I'm more than happy to share it and would love to get it out there. I mean, especially in New Mexico and South Carolina, where they are building a new version of Rocky Flats, new what they're calling pit facilities, which are the triggers, which are the atomic bombs. Those are currently in the works. And the Department of Energy just diamond stamped their first plutonium pit to come from Los Alamos. I think that was, it was October 2nd, so it was very recent.
We did cover that on Nuclear Hot Seat. One final question. Your family, you said, still lives in the Rocky Flats area. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
How are they?
You know, my dad has definitely suffered health issues related to his work at Rocky Flats. And some of my other family members also have health issues. It's a very difficult thing. Like I said earlier, you can't necessarily prove that a cancer or an illness came from a specific place. So it's tough to say whether Rocky Flats has affected my other family members or my dad. It's very clear, and he proved beyond a reasonable doubt that his illnesses did come from Rocky Flats. But for the community members, there's never been an acknowledgement that Rocky Flats has harmed anybody outside of the workers. And, you know, the Department of Energy finally acknowledged after decades and decades of denials that working in these facilities could cause illnesses. That was in the year 2000 that the DOE finally admitted that. And then there was a health compensation program that was started following that. And so some of the workers have been compensated. Over 10,000 sick workers have applied for compensation, just Rocky Flats workers, and under half of them have been compensated.
Is there anything we haven't covered that you'd like to mention now?
I think that this issue is so important, and I hope that everybody in Colorado and across the states has an opportunity to see it. I think it's part of a larger scope of historical things that we have buried and erased. Unfortunately, the United States, we are not good at remembering our history or learning from it, which is clear with what's happening in Los Alamos and down at the Savannah River site, where they're starting new facilities that are going to produce these same things and have the same risks and accidents that are inevitably going to happen. And Rocky Flats was very lucky in that these weren't worse than they are. There were terrible accidents and contamination is all throughout Denver because of it. But it could have been even worse. It could have made Denver and a large part of Colorado, maybe even other states, uninhabitable. It really is a dangerous thing, and plutonium is pyrophoric, meaning that it spontaneously combusts, which is why they've had so many fires. And there's just no way to actually control this material, no matter what the Department of Energy is saying. These accidents will occur again, and it's very sad to see that we're starting that process over.
And if your film were to have an ultimate impact in your best possible imagining, what would that be?
It would be to acknowledge Rocky Flats for what it is. Institutional knowledge has really dissipated. It's been greenwashed. Now it's a wildlife park. I would hope that we would acknowledge what happened there first, and then also do these epidemiological studies and find out what's happening with the community. And also acknowledge that the people in the community have been harmed by it. That's my ultimate goal, and also to prevent this from happening in other places.
We wish you every success with the film, with your art, and with any other projects that you find your way into, because I know, as another activist, it doesn't end. It just keeps going. You've made a remarkable contribution. I have seen the film. It's excellent. If people have an opportunity to go see it, please do. An important piece of our history is there. And for creating, producing, directing, and pulling together your film, The Half-Life of Memory, and all the other work you've done, I want to thank you, Jeff Geip, for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much, Libby, and thank you for all you do to raise awareness about this issue.
That was Jeff Geip, director of the Rocky Flats documentary, Half-Life of Memory, America's Forgotten Atomic Bomb Factory. It will premiere on November 2nd at the Denver Film Festival, and Jeff is open to booking the film almost anywhere. You can contact him directly, and I suggest you do, through halflifeofmemory.com or one of the links we have up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 696. We'll also have a link up to the Denver Film Festival, so if you're in the area and want to attend, we urge you to do so.
Activists, shout out.
More film news. The film San Onofre Syndrome continues to clean up on the festival circuit, having recently been awarded with Best Actuality Subject Award at the 13th Global Nonviolent Film Festival. It's a terrific film, and if you haven't seen it, it is available on Amazon Prime, which is another big step. So check it out there. A little sadder news is that the International Uranium Film Festival, which was scheduled to next be held in December here in Los Angeles, has been postponed because of a number of reasons. Plans are being laid to reschedule it for next year, sometime in the spring or early summer, and to combine it with visits to Window Rock on Navajo Nation, Albuquerque, Las Vegas, and perhaps a few other locations in the western part of the United States. We will, of course, keep you up to date on whatever moves it announces. If you are in New York, you are cordially invited to the Global Peace Flag Exhibit at the United Nations headquarters, which will be on display until November 15, 2024. This exhibit brings together flags from 193 countries, symbolizing a global commitment to peace, unity, and sustainability, all created using repurposed fashion waste. The Global Peace Flag Initiative serves as a powerful testament to our shared vision of a world where art, culture, and creativity lead the way towards environmental and social justice. This unique project aims to inspire collective action and highlight the importance of global cooperation in addressing the challenges of our time. In honor of the Nobel Peace Prize being granted to Nihon Hidankyo, which is a Japanese grassroots organization of A-bomb survivors from World War II, we are all being asked to consider spending 30 minutes in the coming weeks to write and submit a letter to the editor of your local newspaper shining a light on Nihon Hidankyo's award and what it stands for, the imperative to abolish nuclear weapons, and the difference each of us can make in this global effort. This call came out from the group Back from the Brink, which is definitely worth checking out and signing up for their newsletter. There are many other ways Back from the Brink can help you, including providing you with suggested talking points for your letter, assisting you with submitting the letter, and recommending other simple actions you can take to get involved in a way that makes a difference. We'll have a link up to where you can get more information about this on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 696. Just for the heck of it, and because we can always use a chuckle, we're going to link to an article in the Albuquerque Journal entitled, "Nuclear Weapons Have the Potential to Frighten My Nervous Dogs." It's by Barbara Fuller, and I have to admit, it made me chuckle. And I've been holding out the best for last. On December 5th and 6th, the Outrider Foundation is holding a nuclear reporting summit in D.C. to gather together media practitioners, national security experts, policymakers, and scientists. The program will focus on how nuclear weapons issues intersect with artificial intelligence, community health, climate change, local economies, and the environment. Top people will be presenting at all the events, and reporters from around the country, if not around the world, who all focus on nuclear issues, will be present and accounted for. This is a major opportunity to network on nuclear issues from that all-important different perspective. Outrider had never heard of Nuclear Hot Seat until I contacted them and introduced myself, but they responded so well to what they saw of my 13 and a half years of reporting on nuclear issues that they are flying me out and putting me up in order to attend. That's wonderful. However, their grant is not enough to cover all of my travel expenses. So if you'd like to help me attend and not go in the hole, please go to the website nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. Or you can send through Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. All funds received that are over the amount required for this trip will be rolled over into a fund to get me to New York in March 2025 for the United Nations third meeting of states parties on the treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons. There's never a dull day when it comes to reporting on nuclear. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 21st, 2024. Want to make certain you never miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat? Well, just mosey on down to the website. There's a yellow opt-in box that will pop up so that you can't miss it. Fill in your first name and an email address, and shazam! You will get one email a week, just one, we don't bug you, that has a link to that week's show and a little bit about the content. Doing it that way helps us with our Google algorithm. Or, if you're a regular consumer of podcasts, whatever your favorite podcast platform is, go there and sign up for Nuclear Hot Seat. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to the website and click on that red donate button, we really need your help. And considering that next month we hit episode number 700, you might want to do something that commemorates us. Anything helps, everything helps, and we will really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby, Halevi, and Hartestree Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, name of guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as President Kennedy said of his hawkish military advisors during the Cuban Missile Crisis, nuclear deterrence works brilliantly until it stops working, and then none of us will be alive to tell them they were wrong. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.